It's me in the small in the morning, and then Paulo in the afternoon. What's Paulo doing, Ago?
Team management.
Who?
Team management.
I guess he knows something about that, huh? Well, we're gonna see if we can finish church history. So we left off on, I think it's session 9 for you, isn't it? Yeah. Session 9. Excellent. This session is called Rationalism and Revival, and we're 1648. 1648 was the reason why we use that as a day. That was the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War. So at this point, Europe is exhausted, tired of religion, and this is an era of not only rationalism, which we'll explain, but also revival. And those two will sort of grow side by side during this period. The Enlightenment, or Age of Reason, was a European intellectual movement that exalted... We okay? Yeah, okay, thank you. That exalted reason and science. It was characterized by an optimistic faith in man and his unlimited ability to understand and eventually control everything in the natural world. So are you familiar with the term postmodernism? Well, postmodernism is a reaction to what we just read there. That's a description of modernism as defined by the Enlightenment. So modernism, the modern era, was a time that exalted reason, science, characterized by an optimistic faith in man. In other words, all the answers... Man has all the answers to all the problems. All he needs is enough time and enough resources, and every problem is solvable. Not only all of the scientific, technical problems, but we can apply those same principles to all social and moral problems. We can solve every one of our problems. We have the resources. We can ultimately control everything in the natural world, including human behavior. So we can eliminate once and for all of the evils of the world through man's reason, through his man's mind. And so this has come as a general disillusionment with religion and a renewed confidence in science. In 1688, Isaac Newton is going to publish his groundbreaking work called Principia Mathematica, in which he describes most of the phenomena in the physical world under three simple basic laws. And this convinces man that scientific laws undergird everything in the universe. And those same laws that are used to control nature, we can use to control human behavior. So, very optimistic period of time, you see. Now, postmodernism is the result of that experiment being proven false. So, eventually, through a whole series of events and situations, a spirit of skepticism and really despair that we can't answer the important questions. And there is no ultimate foundational truth that we can base everything on as a reaction to this period of time. Does that make sense to you? This is not a class in Western thought or philosophy, but just a little bit of a background. Now, some of the significant personalities of the Enlightenment, and this sort of frames because the church is going to, from this point on, the church will be reacting and responding to this secular view that dominates life. So you need to know a few of the characters. The first one is René Descartes. D-E-S-C-A-R-T-E-S. Okay, pronounced Descartes, not Descartes. Descartes? No. Descartes, everybody say that with me. Descartes. Yeah, no S at the end, just Descartes. Descartes, yeah. 1596, 1650, Descartes' intellectual quest for certainty began with a commitment to radical skepticism and ended in an epistemology firmly centered on reason and mathematics. Okay, a few terms we probably need to define there. Epistemology, I think we broached this topic last time we met. Epistemology is the study of knowledge. Essentially, epistemology asks the question, what can we know? And how do we know that we know it? What can we know? And how do we know that we know it? And it was the failure of modern man in the Enlightenment experiment to answer that question and come up with a consistent epistemology that's led to the breakdown of the 21st century. So just about everything that we're experiencing in the 21st century was a failure of man to come up with a basis for knowledge that was certain. How can we really be certain about anything? That's why we live in an age of radical skepticism and radical relativism. Right? My truth is my truth. Your truth is your truth. If it works for you, that's wonderful. Just don't try to put your truth on me. I have my own truth, and we respect one another. That's because of a breakdown of Descartes' experiment. Descartes started, his real quest was, how can we be absolutely certain? I want to build a foundation of knowledge that starts with absolute certainty, which is the quest in every man's heart. We want to be certain about something. Now, prior to Descartes, the basic answer to that is because there's a God who lives and exists and is real, he communicates real knowledge to us. And so we have certainty based on the fact that there's someone out there who knows everything. See, one of the problems with certainty, to be certain, you have to have taken into account all the possible variables. And in order to do that, what's the one thing that you need? What's the one thing you need?
A constant.
Huh? What? A constant? Okay. Otto, what do you want to say? You have to know every fact. You see, because there's always a possibility that there's something that you overlooked, a bit of information, that when that's discovered, it will change everything. Which is really, that's the history of science. When you look back to the history of science, absolute certainty, we're sure about something, and then new information changes the whole paradigm. And so, in order to have absolute certainty, you need to know every fact. Because there's always a possibility that there's another fact out there that is going to change everything that you thought you were so certain about. Right? So, for example, prior to Copernicus, we were certain that the universe and everything revolved around the earth, right? And according to observation, it looked like that was the case. But then what happens is there's advances in optics that create better measuring devices, and so we can begin to better measure the movement of the planets, and all of a sudden, there's all these anomalies. You know what an anomaly is? It's a bit of information that doesn't fit in this nice, neat package that we have. And so they started creating all these different crazy anomalies, and it was extremely complex until Copernicus comes on the scene and says, I got a different proposal. What if everything, all the planets actually revolve around the sun? And now that solved all of those complex problems. That's the history of science. You see, new data comes in, something we thought we were sure about, now we see we've thought completely wrong, and it changes everything. So to have absolute certainty, you need absolute knowledge. Or there's one other possibility. One other possibility. You don't have absolute knowledge, but you know somebody who does. You know someone who does. Lee pointed to June over here. No, not even June fits that criteria. So you see, Descartes' experiment is doomed from the beginning. Because only a Christian can have certainty. Only a Christian can be sure, because we know someone who knows everything. And there's another important factor. Not only do you have to know somebody who knows everything, there's two important factors. Number one, he has to be willing to tell you. So the God of deism is not good enough, because he might know everything, but he has no concern about you or desire to tell you everything. So, number one, he has to have a willingness to tell you. And then what else, Noel? It's crucial. First of all, you got to know somebody who knows everything. He's got to be willing to communicate it to you. And the most important thing, Dennis?
He has a way of communicating.
Okay, that's under number two. Yeah, he can communicate with you. But number three, most important of all.
He must be able to give it the information to you.
That's under communication, yeah.
Okay,
yeah. Well, because he has all knowledge, so that one's covered in number one. Most important one of all. Well, that's under communication, so he has the ability to communicate. What? Yeah, that's under communication. What? No, no. What, Patrick? He has to be trustworthy. Doesn't do you much good to know somebody who knows everything, who's willing to tell you, if every once in a while he likes to throw you a curveball, play a trick on you. Some of you may have had an older brother like that who would feed you information and then every once in a while tell you something, get you to believe it, and make you look like a total fool. So this being has to know all, have to have all knowledge, has to be, have a mechanism for communication that's effective, and number three, has to be trustworthy. So you see, only the Christian can be certain, because we have a God who knows everything, he's not silent, he has communicated, and he's absolutely trustworthy. So Descartes started, he rejected that epistemology. And he began with his epistemology, let's start with reason, without revelation. What man can figure out just by observation and by his mental processes. So he started this process, let's doubt everything, and whatever is left, that will be our foundation. So the modern world, and Descartes considered the first modern philosopher, this is the beginning of the modern world, starts with radical skepticism. Let's doubt everything. So one particular day, it was a snowy day, and he stayed inside and sat by a warm fire and began this process of radical skepticism, doubting everything. So he just systematically just started doubting. And he got even down to how could he know that he actually existed? Like he said, I think that I'm sitting in front of a warm fire, but we've all had dreams before that were so real. When we woke up, it took a while for us to realize, did that really happen, or was it a dream? Maybe I'm just dreaming. Or maybe there's a big demon that's deceiving me, making me think I'm sitting in front of this fire, and actually I'm not at all. And then he had the revelation. This is the modern world is based on this. He said it in Latin, cogito ergo sum. Or you probably heard it as, I think, therefore I am. In other words, there's one thing that he could be sure of, that there is a thinking substance. Now, he didn't know, he couldn't be sure if he had a body or not yet, but he knew that there was something that was thinking, something that's doubting. And so that becomes his framework. Now, that's something that nobody can doubt or challenge. And he built a whole philosophy, a whole epistemology based on that thought. If you saw the movie, oh, I just lost the name of it, with Leonardo DiCaprio. Inception, yeah. So Inception is really, it's Descartes gone mad. So it's the ultimate conclusion of Descartes' experiment. Remember how the movie ends? With the top spinning? And then it cuts off at the last moment? Does the top continue spinning? Or does it topple? We can never know. That's the ultimate end of Descartes' experiment. Absolute knowledge is impossible. Descartes has failed. We can't know anything. Nothing is real. We can't be sure. And so that's, if you want to understand the 21st century, why people do crazy things, why music, why people make songs, they do the way they do, movies, everything, it goes back to Descartes' cogito ergo sum, and then man thinking, now I've got a foundation, and realizing that is just shifting sand, and there's no foundation. We can't be certain of anything at all. Descartes. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, at least as much as it can. Right? So that's why the world's insane. They're philosophically insane because there's no foundation for truth or knowledge. We can't be sure. It just becomes my opinion, my view. You got your view, I got my view. There's no way to ever know which one is superior to the other. So we might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. All right, John Locke is next. John Locke, L-O-C-K-E. John Locke, although Locke was an Orthodox Christian, his writings on epistemology emphasize reason to such an extent that revelation was discounted by many who followed him. So he started, each one of these are building on each other, and Locke produces this whole system of philosophy based on reason. Did any of you follow the television series Lost? A few people. Remember, there's a character on there, John Locke, right? Who, from the beginning, he is the opposite, really, of John Locke, the philosopher, because he has faith apart from reason. So if you followed it, you wasted a lot of time. I'm speaking from personal experience. Okay, now Locke leads to Isaac Newton. We mentioned him earlier. Newton's book, Principia Mathematica, presented the universe as a well-oiled machine and helped propagate the philosophy of deism. See, we're going to watch this process. So throughout the Middle Ages, the Christian gospel is the primary philosophy. And now with Descartes, slowly that's going to begin to erode. And it's Descartes, Locke, and even Newton, who, although Newton was a practicing churchman and orthodox, at least in his external beliefs, probably actually a closet sun worshiper and pagan, but their views led from basic theism, the belief in a creator, personal God, to deism. Now, have you heard the term deism? Yeah? No? Maybe? Okay. Deism is the belief that a omnipotent being started the universe, got everything in line, gave it its first big push, and then checked out. Every year, they have a major international dominoes competition. You know what dominoes are? Now, they don't play the game. They set up dominoes in this very massive, intricate settings, and teams compete to see who wins the international championship. And it's quite fascinating. I know the last one that I saw, the last victory, they had, I can't remember how many hundreds of thousands of dominoes they had set up, but from the time they gave the first push, it took 4.5 minutes for all these dominoes to fall. And they had an entire warehouse, about an acre worth of space. And each domino had different colors. And so as it turned over, like they would hit a room maybe the size, an area the size of this room, and all of them would turn over, and it would create this whole picture of something. So the theme was music, I think rock and roll music. And so maybe as all the dominoes would fall, a picture of Elvis Presley would be revealed. And then it would lead off to another section, and this, can you imagine this massive, gigantic warehouse and dominoes just falling everywhere. Now that's kind of a picture of deism's view of the world, is this intellect, this giant intellect, got all his dominoes in place. Massive quantity of dominoes, and then gave the one first push. And since that, every domino has been falling in line. You see? And so everything that happens is the direct result of a domino falling just prior to that event. So every event in history is just one domino after another falling because of this being that gave the first push. So he's like the unmoved mover, the prime cause, the first principle. He gave everything a push. So that explains the universe. We explain why the universe is created. But what it does is it pushes God sufficiently out of the universe because we don't have to deal with him personally. So he's not a God who redeems, who cares about sin. There's no morality. It's just impersonal forces. And this happens because Isaac Newton, the universe looks like this gigantic clock. Everything works in this amazing clockwork function. And so you can predict, for example, one of Newton's laws, or when you combine Newton's laws, it says that if you had a pool table, and you know the initial placement of one particular ball and the initial placement of another, and you knew all the variables of the speed of the cue ball when it got hit, the angle that it struck the other ball, and velocity and various other factors, you could predict with 100% accuracy where that ball would land when it was finished. That's Newton's ideas. Now, of course, these get shattered in the 21st century. How many saw the movie Jurassic Park? Jurassic Park. So you're familiar with the scene with Jeff Goldblum, his character. He's talking about chaos theory, right? So basically, chaos theory destroys Newton in the sense that tiny little factors that there's no possible way of knowing will interfere with the trajectory of the ball. And all we can do is predict with some degree of certainty a range of possibilities. Yeah, so that's chaos, really, which is Descartes' worldview just breaking down. And we can't be certain, really, about anything. So, how are you doing with that section? You okay? Yeah, Cleve. I was waiting for you. You got a microphone?
Forgive my ignorance, Paul, but I was under the understanding that with deism, there's sort of a good works.
Yeah.
Because the founder was Herbert. Some
Say again?
Herbert.
George?
Yeah, George Herbert, I think. And
yeah.
Within his theology was that there's this big God, and you have to do good. He's basically Armenian, but Jesus Christ.
Just got to stir it up, don't you? Stir it up. Stir that pot.
Because you mentioned that in deism, it's just no morality, etc. So I was wondering if...
No transcendent morality. So now deists were very concerned about morality, but it was based on natural law. So it's a morality based on natural law. That's how we control people's behaviors and actions.
Not because... Could you define natural law?
Well, there's, as opposed to revelation. So the Christian ethic is based on revelation. We know what's right and wrong because a God, a being, communicates truth to us in a book about what's right and wrong. So he gives us the standards for morality. Now in deism, we have no being like that to communicate right and wrong. So what we have to do is by just examining nature and using reason, determine what is right and wrong. In other words, how can men live together in society? So natural law tells us if men are going to live together, that they have natural rights.
So this predates the social contract concept.
Yeah, it's social contract kind of idea, right. It's a morality based on reason and observation as opposed to revelation. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Richard, get him a mic, would you please? Do we just have two? Three? Yeah. Go ahead, Richard.
Isaac Newton is a Christian, right?
Say again?
Is he really a Christian?
Who?
Isaac Newton.
I don't think so, no.
Because I was just wondering, I've read some books that refer to him as a quote-unquote Christian, but who probably have influenced him as far as the philosophy of deism is concerned?
He wasn't a Christian. I mean, he couldn't have gotten into our church. But he was externally a practicing churchgoer and devout.
So most probably he came from a Christian family or
I mean, this is the 1600s, so you don't have any choices. It's not like there's Christian or non-Christian. I mean, everybody is, if you're a citizen of a nation of Europe, you're a Christian. I mean, you've been baptized, right? I mean, the whole, there's no such thing, there's no skeptics, everybody is a practice, or at least nominally, you've been baptized, you go or you don't go. So he was a faithful church goer and overtly held to the basic tenets of Christianity. So you can see in some of his writings, it sounds like he's a good church person. The reality is he was fascinated with pagan religions and probably actually worshiped the sun. So, and practice pagan rituals and rites, but that was a little side note. You couldn't actually do that in public, because you might lose your head, or, I mean, literally lose your head. So, some people like to claim him as a Christian, and certainly his worldview was much more Christian than his actual practices. You know, it's possible to have a worldview to think like a Christian and not actually live and practice like a Christian. Right? Does that make sense to you? So his worldview was shaped by biblical thought, although probably not a real genuine believer. I don't know. Any other questions? Okay, that's just the foundation. Okay, while all this is happening, and the world is generally going extremely secular at this point, now something else begins to happen in the church. So we start with the first great awakening, and it refers to a period in American history from 1735 to 1750 when the churches were stirred to life and many people were converted. But actually, the great awakening in America also parallels in England at that time. There's an evangelical awakening with Whitfield and Wesley. And in Germany and other parts of Europe, there's a pietistic revival with Count Zinzendorf and the Moravians. So there's revival taking place in significant places throughout the world. But probably the most significant one was the First Great Awakening in America. So a few thoughts about that. In 1734, Jonathan Edwards, have you heard that name before? Jonathan Edwards, good. preached a series of sermons on justification by faith. In December of that year, he reported the Spirit of God began extraordinarily to set in and wonderfully to work among us. So revival begins in colonial America. Now, of course, this is 1734, so there's really no such thing as the United States of America at this point. But these are the colonies, right? The English colonies. Now, Jonathan Edwards was colonial America's greatest theologian. He had a grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, who pastored 60 years in New England. And during that 60 years, he saw five significant revivals during that time. And when Edwards was 24, he took over for his grandfather in his parsonage. But by the time he did, people had sort of backslidden. They were in kind of a cold, dead state. And so he begins to preach on justification by faith, and revival sweeps not only his congregation, his town, but this whole extensive river valley area in New England. And he's probably best known for his most famous sermon is called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And it's quite a sermon. You can get it pretty easily. Just type Jonathan Edwards sermons or Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God and read it. One of the most famous sermons in history. Jonathan Edwards was not a dynamic communicator. He wrote out his sermons, a full manuscript, and then brought the full manuscript into the pulpit and simply read it. And he didn't have very good eyesight, so he'd kind of have to lean over and he'd just sit there and just read his sermon with very little eye contact with his audience or not a whole lot of, obviously, you know, you can't move around very much because you're reading, and he's got a little candle there at the pulpit to kind of provide a little bit of light, so he doesn't move, not dynamic at all. Probably our Filipino congregation would have a hard time if we preached like that. But Jonathan Edwards spent an average of 13 hours a day in prayer and Bible study. So when you spend that much time seeking God, it's amazing how much power and how little it actually depends on your presentation. So when he read this sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and it's a pretty brutal sermon. There's no real altar call at the end. There's not a whole lot of redemption at the end. He paints a picture of his congregation as spiders hanging by a thin thread that any moment could snap and they could fall eternally into hell. It's a pretty graphic description of these sinners that are just perched on the edge of hell that any moment they might die and fall into eternity. But because of the prayer behind it, as he read the sermon, people in the audience began to actually see the flames of hell beneath their feet. It was as if the floor moved away and they could see hell. And people actually began holding on to the pillars of the church because they felt like if they didn't, they would slip down into hell. And they began to cry out in agony. And several times Edwards had to pause them because he couldn't continue on because their noise was so loud they were drowning him out. And so, please stop, I'm trying to read my sermon. So he would calm them down and read some more. And as a result of that, God's power began to sweep that area. He wrote about this, he said, the number of saints multiplied. It soon made a glorious alteration in the town, so that the whole town seemed to be full of the presence of God. It was never so full of love or joy, and yet also distress. Because you had either broken through into conversion, and you were filled with joy, or you were experiencing tremendous conviction about your sins, and you were under terrible distress. By far, the greater number of people above 16 years of age have been converted. So just about everybody in the town was converted, including there was a great revival among the young people who had powerful conversion experience. He was a prolific author, wrote over 1,000 sermons. Edwards published account of revival called A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God, prepared New England for awakening, but it was the preaching of George Whitefield that brought many to life, and we'll talk about George in a minute. As many as 50,000 people were added to the membership of the New England churches, which is about 15% of the entire population. Which, you know, it's pretty good when you think about Metro Manila, 18 million or so, 15%. What is that? 1.89? About 2.7 million in about a 15-year period. So, you know, that's a pretty significant revival that took place. The number of churches in the Middle and Southern colonies tripled. It brought major changes to the religious and political thought of colonial Americans, including many of the founding fathers who would later shape the destiny of the fledgling nation. What happened is because this revival is taking place when most of the men who would shape the founding of America were teenagers or young people or in their early 20s, and most of them were influenced by the revival. And so they had a genuine conversion experience. Now, of course, some, Thomas Jefferson, others, Thomas Paine, were deists and skeptics, but by and large, a good percentage of the early men who were influential in shaping the U.S. Constitution and establishing our nation were genuine, born-again believers who actually looked to the scriptures to inform their development of this new political organization. So, for example, the tricameral process that we have three bodies. We have a legislative, a judicial, and an executive branch that maybe is duplicated here. I would imagine something similar. Most people have duplicated that. That comes straight from Isaiah chapter 33, which says God is our lawgiver, our judge, and our king. So the idea is based on there's three branches of government. God, because he's perfect, he can do all three of them. But man, because he's a fallen sinner, can't. And so we have to separate, balance these powers, separation of power. Because if you combine them all into one man or one group, they will ultimately, because of their sinful nature, they'll be corrupt and they will corrupt others. So they're influenced by this revival, you see, and it has a significant impact in establishing the United States of America. And also another significant thing we'll see in the next session is it produced an increasing concern for missions and education. Now, some of the exciting leaders during this period, George Whitefield, one of the most fascinating people in church history. How many have heard of George Whitefield? At least know his name, heard of him. 1714 to 1770. Led to Christ by Charles Wesley. I'm surprised how many people don't know Charles Wesley. We did a song at the fort this Sunday that I took. Wesley was a hymn writer. He published over 6,000 hymns in his life, which, you know, when you think about 30, 35 years, 6,000 hymns, that's about 200 songs a year that he wrote and produced. And all of them thick. Not like most of our praise songs, which are, if not sometimes theologically questionable, at least fairly thin. Not a lot of depth. But if you look at one of Wesley's hymns, there's great theological depth. And he was doing 200 a year for 30 years. So we've taken some of his old hymns. I reworked one of them and updated the language and changed some things. And Archie wrote a melody to it. And we did it at church. And I'm surprised how many people, because it had my name and Archie's and Charles Wesley. So people knew me and Archie, but who's this Charles Wesley guy? Really? You don't know who Charles Wesley is? So somebody said, hey, that's a nice song you wrote. Actually, it was mostly Charles. Charles and I worked together on it. Said, who's Charles? Charles Wesley. One girl said, isn't he dead? Yes, for a long time. But Charles led George Whitefield to Christ, and he became a member of the Holy Club at Oxford. Now, a little background about Whitefield. Fascinating guy. He grew up in, his parents were publicans. You know what a publican is? A public, not a Republican. A publican, somebody owns a pub. So they owned a pub in the southwestern part of England. And so George Whitefield, he grew up in a bar, essentially. Although an English pub is a lot different than certainly an American bar. Much more of a family environment than you would think, you know, when you think about a bar. But, you know, it's essentially, it's a pub. It's an inn to where travelers stay. And so he grew up unchurched and in a sinful environment, and always travelers coming through. And he was the entertainer. So he had a remarkable ability to imitate people. So he just meets someone for a brief period, and he could mock their mannerisms or duplicate their speech patterns, etc. And so he was the big entertainer. Everybody loved him, and he wanted a career in acting. That's what he wanted to do. And he had a majestic voice. Benjamin Franklin, who later on is going to be a business partner with him. Benjamin Franklin, who certainly wasn't a Christian, but he was a great businessman. And Benjamin Franklin was pioneering printing in the colonies. And so Franklin and Whitefield entered into a business deal where Franklin would publish his sermons. So they had a business arrangement for a long period of time. And Franklin once counted, or gave a pretty good count, of the number of people who could hear Whitefield clearly when he was preaching a sermon. Now, of course, there's no amplification. An outdoor sermon. And Franklin said, about 30,000. Now, there would be more people there than that, but after 30,000, it was pretty hard to hear. Some of the crowds in Hyde Park in London, Whitefield preached to upwards of 80,000 without mic amplification. Now, after 30,000, you couldn't hear them, but up to 30,000 people, you could still hear them. Now, that's pretty good. You think about 30,000, okay? So just imagine. So, for example, Sunday at the fort, I guess our building holds 1,200, 1,400, something like that. Yeah? So could you imagine preaching in that building without any amplification? That's just 1,200 or 1,400. Start multiplying that, 30,000 people could hear him. So he had this massive, booming voice that was so dramatic. The most famous Shakespearean actor of his day, David Garrick, heard him speak, and he was so impressed, he said, I'd give 100 guineas, which was a lot of money, just to be able to say the word, oh, like George Whitefield. So he's got this amazing, powerful voice. He wants to be an actor. He's an entertainer and very gifted guy. But he goes to Oxford, and he meets Charles and then later John Wesley, and they got this thing called the Holy Club, which the Methodist Church is going to spring from that. And so they begin to preach the gospel to him, and Whitefield goes through this terrible period of conversion experience, and he finally breaks through, and he gets converted. And as soon as he's converted, he preaches his first sermon. Okay, he's just been born again, but he's gone through this period of about 2 years when he's been under terrible conviction, and actually the Wesley brothers thought he was going to commit suicide. They had to have him under 24-hour suicide watch because he was under such conviction of sin. But when he finally breaks through, he preaches his first sermon, and the bishop, who was there in attendance, said that 15 people were driven mad. He drove 15 people mad. In other words, they heard the gospel and they became so convicted of their sin, it was like they were like madmen. He was 21 years old, first sermon. Now, one time he's preaching, and I'm reading a description from his biography. The sermon was entitled, "It's Appointed Unto Man Once to Die." That was his text. And as he's preaching, a wild, terrifying shriek came from the audience. One of his ministers pressed through the crowd to find out what it was. And he cried out, he said, "Brother Whitfield, you stand among the dead and the living. An immortal soul has been called into eternity. The destroying angel is passing over the congregation. Cry aloud and spare not." In other words, during his preaching, someone dropped dead. Like Ananias and Sapphira. Someone who's resisting the gospel and bam, just dropped dead in the middle of his sermon. So it continues. After a moment's silence, he began again, only to hear a second shriek. And a second person died. Everyone that day was converted. Except for two. Except for two.
I've been able to put people to sleep.
They've dropped for you, but for other reasons, huh? Lined up against the back wall at Ortigas and then they just collapse. Yeah, that's powerful preaching, right? When people die in the middle of your sermon because they're resisting God, judgment comes, and pretty easy to get a good response. What's that?
He wasn't convicted.
He convicted?
No, it was murder.
Murder.
Yeah, murder by preaching. I don't know. The doctrine of providence? I think that's the doctrine of judgment right there. Now, one of the things that Whitfield did is, and the first person in modern history, he left the churches and he started preaching out in the open fields. So the churches began to close to him. You know, the Church of England, the Anglican Church, would not let him preach. You know, people die in your church services. And I mean, he's preaching the gospel. And at this point, most of the Church of England is pretty dead, religious. And so he's causing quite a stir. So they won't let him preach in the churches, so he just goes out in the fields and starts preaching these open-air meetings, which he did most of his life. And it was in those open-air meetings that thousands and hundreds of thousands were converted. He had a pretty regular schedule. He would rise at 4 o'clock every morning, and he would preach. He'd start preaching at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock during the winter hours, and he would preach every day, morning, afternoon, and night, and on Sundays, 6 a.m., and 6 p.m. Monday through Thursday and Saturdays. He would preach about 40 to 60 hours a week in sermons. So he's a preaching machine. I mean, he's constantly just preaching. 40 hours a week. He actually became, you know, of course, English, but he came to America 7 times. And he's the primary instrument that God uses to bring revival all up and down the American coastline. It's estimated that during his lifetime, 80% of all the living Americans at that time heard him preach. 80%. And that he probably preached to, in his lifetime, 10 million people. 10 million people in his audience, which is pretty significant. first modern evangelist to travel and preach to large crowds in fields and town squares. Now, John Wesley, okay? Interesting character. One of my favorite characters in church history. Although we have a little different theology, and yet I probably read and studied more on Wesley's life than any other character. Fascinated by him. He was the 15th of 19 children, born to Reverend Samuel and Susanna Wesley, trained for the ministry at Oxford and ordained a priest in 1724. Now, he almost wasn't born. He was born in 1703. If you know a little bit about the English history at this point, there was a controversy about the rightful king. Okay, without going into a whole lot of the history, the bottom line is that Samuel, his father, upheld the current monarchy of William was the king at that point, and his mother, Susanna, thought that he was a usurper. He wasn't the rightful king. And so one time at prayer, the father prays a prayer of blessing over the king, and the mother won't say amen. She won't amen the prayer. Because she won't agree with any prayer that blesses the usurper. He's not the rightful king. And Samuel challenges her. And they have a pretty big fight. And so he's pretty stubborn about it. And he says, then we will not share a bed until you can say amen to my prayer. And so he moves out. And he moves to London. And both sides are tremendously stubborn. You can see where their son gets their characteristic. They're not giving in. Now, there might not have been a John Wesley. But William died. And Anne was instituted as the monarch. And both of them could agree together. And so Samuel came back home, and just shortly after coming back home, Susanna conceived, and John Wesley was born, fortunately for us. Now, his father was the vicar of the Church of England in Epworth, which is in Lincolnshire, and one particular night, I think there's 8 kids at this particular time, there's a fire. Fires were fairly common in those days, a fire in the parsonage where they lived, and at night, so they frantically got all the kids out, you know, and they were watching essentially their parsonage, their home, just burning, and the neighbors had come, there's no way to put it out, and they're doing a count, kind of like the Home Alone movie, you know, counting, but when they got together and they did the count, there was one missing, and they looked up and 5-year-old John was in the second floor window, and the flames were engulfing the house, and it looked like he was about to die. Samuel ran in and tried to rescue him, but the flames were too much, and he was beaten back. And then so then they just knelt down on the ground, and they committed their son to God. He was basically going to burn and die. And a neighbor had a ladder, and they tried to put that ladder up, but it collapsed. And so then they climbed on the back of one another, and at the last moment, they were able to reach and grab his hand, and they pulled him out, and as soon as they did, the entire house collapsed in flames, and he was saved. And his mother remembered that event and there's a passage in the book of Isaiah referring to a brand plucked from the fire. And so she wrote in her diary, to mark this child, that God has saved him for a special destiny. And so for the rest of Wesley's life, he was aware that he had a special destiny, that he was a brand plucked from the fire, that God had saved him for a special purpose. And that idea informed and influenced his whole life, that sense of destiny. Let's take a break.